Everyone awake and ready?
Awake and ready.
Ready for our meditation until midnight?
Yes.
All of those who brave the roads, and there are others who plan to come, but particularly further north, there's snow, and so some people didn't come to plan, so keep them in our spirit here. Let us go within. And thinking of all the things that you bring in with you from the world, concerns, worries, preoccupations of the mind. And this is a time to let those go. But we can focus our minds exclusively upon the divine presence within. Think about a flaming light in front of you. And all those things, there's concerns about finances, health, job, family, whatever the circumstances, you put it into the flame. You let it go. You see the flame take those worries, those concerns, takes it, absorbs it, purifies it, lifts it up. Taking all the stress and strain that you may have been feeling and giving it all at the feet of God, giving it into the flame of light, that it is a time of fresh beginnings, to wipe the page clean, and so that you might enter in like a newborn, fresh, with wonder, innocence, everything else left behind. Now, if you'll pray with me, O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Dearest Mother, Saints and sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king. Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. That I put out today. As I think of the coming of the new year, I picture opening a new book or a fresh unmarked page upon which to write. Perhaps sitting in a theater waiting for the performance to begin. There is openness, a hushed expectation, curiosity, and a desire to know what the supreme author will scribe, say, or do in your life. The start of anything can be exciting, tenuous, and uncertain all at the same time. Through the years, we can become over-familiar with life, and in doing so, we lose many precious qualities, becoming dulled to life wonders, entrenched in sameness, hypnotized by fear, lack, self-condemnation, or enmeshed in bitterness. These are life-killing tendencies and suck joy right out of us. These perspectives are simply states of mind, as demonstrated by the fact that the person next to us with very similar circumstances can have a completely different and elevated attitude. The very root of this universe is Ananda. It is an explosion of joyful bliss, and life when lived in God, is filled with divine presence. No matter how far we wander from it, our source, it never stops being the essence of who and what we are. This is a fact. It has been a source of great mischief that religious leaders invented eternal hell and damnation. Reason tells us that God, being creator of all, is more loving than the most devoted parent, will never abandon his children, never. We are made in his likeness and his image, and therefore we are eternally his. The real question, then, is how to consciously reestablish that connection. For that, we have been given the truth by living spiritual masters, and we have received the means to practice the very highest methods for realizing God by our guru lineage. Mental speculation is but a vague shadow compared to the light of realization. To step into that light, we must strive with all of our might. With great courage, we must step out of the shadows and be illumined. Sri Yukteswarji assured us that all of us have a trail of misdeeds littered behind us, but that should not stop us in striving for self-realization. But neither will spiritual laziness get us to the goal. I have devotees tell me that they have no time for meditation because they play golf each morning. Some who wish to drink alcohol or use drugs, others are driven by the need to socialize with friends, watch TV, or surf the net. There are a million excuses, but there is one compelling reason for knowing God. It is only through oneness with Him that we can have lasting happiness, a fulfillment that does not diminish with time, nor is severed by death. As aspirants, we continue to live in the body, in this world. As such, there are things we must have for survival of this body: clothing, shelter, and food. At times we need medical care. For many who have taken on the responsibilities of family, the list grows longer. So, we work to have balance in our lives. There are legitimate desires to fulfill living in this material realm. For some, it is completing education, excelling in a profession, building a business, or raising a family. Looking to the new year, we can take into account the many aspects of life, material as well as spiritual. Create a clear picture of who you want to be and what you want to accomplish, for every creation begins with an idea. Putting yourself into that picture, feel what it is like, the sense of self-mastery, the balance, peace, bliss, wisdom, the whole package. Then also think of accomplishing what you have come to do in this world: service to humanity, the fulfillment of your dreams. Expand your consciousness to comfortably and easily accommodate your dreams. Definitely invite God to be co-creator with you. Remember, you are made in His likeness and His image. There are no limits to what He can do through you. Blessings. Blessings for the unwritten pages that will be filled with the unfolding days of this new year, and that you be a perfect conduit for the supreme light of this world to manifest through every thought, word, and action. And from Papa Ramdas, I'd like to read, Self-realization, its impact on society. A student is asking Papa, how does self-realization of an individual help society? Ramdas, by self-realization, you become happy inwardly and therefore seek nothing from the outside. So your activities flow out only for the uplift and good of others. A man who is discontented within seeks for external changes in order to get happiness, and so doing harms society. He thinks he will get happiness from external objects. When you have found true happiness by realizing the self, with a capital S, that is, by realizing that your true nature is absolute peace and bliss. You are not in conflict with anybody. Your vision is equal, and your activities turn to service of everyone. Then it is that you become the true instrument of God. Our little self stands in the way of our doing good to the world. Not only do we not do good, but we harm the world. As the spirit of exploitation seizes us, and we do things only as prompted by the ego. After self-realization, our life will be entirely dedicated to the service of humanity. The happiest man is the most generous man. The miserly man and selfish man, besides being miserable himself, makes others near him also unhappy. The student again asks, when he gets the supreme bliss, he indulges in it for himself. How are others benefited thereby? From Ram Dass, that is not like the enjoyment of the senses. A burning lamp cannot hide its light. So when bliss is experienced within yourself, you spread it everywhere around you. It is not for any one individual, but for the whole universe. Devotee. It says that the self-realized beings do not move in society. Is that correct? Ram Dass, are you sure? Mm-hmm. If so, give an example. The great teachers were not selfish. They did not keep to themselves the spiritual knowledge they had gained. They lived in the world to elevate those who came in contact with them. Take the case of Buddha and Shankara. How much did they wander about for the uplift of people? They did not keep away from society or remain in solitude. It's an interesting discussion, isn't it? And it's one that we can take heart of, because you can think to yourself, perhaps, the time you spend in meditation, the time that you spend communing with God, certainly it is to get that realization. It's to be lifted up. But you do not just lift yourself up. Jesus himself said, and if I be lifted up, shall lift up all mankind with me. We are all connected by invisible links. And what one person does affects every other person. If one person degrades their life, then all those who are connected with that individual experience the pull downwards. Now, a strong individual can always overcome that pull, but those who are of lesser strength of will feel the influence and will find themselves pulled down as well. Others who are lifted up can lift up all those around them, whether they ever say a word about it, whether ever they do anything differently about it. There's a light that radiates from that individual, and as they are lifted up, they pull everyone up with them. Now, Jesus said, and if I be lifted up, shall lift up the entire world. And yet we look around us and we see that the entire world hasn't been lifted into the kingdom of heaven that he enjoyed. But the meaning is more subtle than that. He has a beneficial influence on all this world. And you think of one man who lived 2,000 years ago and the tremendous impact he's had on this world. How his teachings have gone out to millions and billions of people, and people of various states of consciousness take those teachings and they do with them what they will. Some people take them and they put them to misuse, and they talk about things they know not of. And as a result of that, ignorance is spread. But that's not the fault of Jesus. Others who are more closely attuned to him will be lifted up and lift up so many others as well. St. Francis is such a wonderful example of that. He existed in the Dark Ages when things were very dark indeed. Reading and writing had come almost to a standstill. Hardly anybody did it. There was very little organization in terms of governments. It was a strong man around who ruled everything. So it was a dark time in terms of history. And yet St. Francis took simple words to live simply as the birds in the air and as the bees and as all of these things of nature, and will God not take care of you? And somehow it awakened something tremendous in him. And so he determined within himself to live as Jesus had spoken about. In the very simplicity, and to spend his time in deepening prayer, he just didn't sit on his hands and wait for somebody to do something for him. He went to work within the laboratory of his own soul. He dug deep through prayer and through focusing upon God, through singing. He loved song. He loved nature, and so he communed with nature. He saw God in nature, and he sang to God. And through that, his mind was purified, and he was lifted up. There's the wonderful story of when he decided to celebrate Christmas Eve, the time as Joseph and Mary arrived in the cave, and Mary gave birth to Jesus. Believe it or not, this is the first time that this had been celebrated in this way. But he found a cave, and they put some straw, and they brought some animals and put it in, and they had everything set, and they even put a little cradle that was empty. And he began to worship with all of his heart, with all of his soul. St. Francis had such a laser-like mind that whatever he put it on, that he went to, and he went toward that devotion to this baby Jesus, to this event of God coming into the world. And his devotion and his zeal and that of the devotees who were around him was so great that a light began to emanate. And the town nearby saw this tremendous light, and they thought it was a fire, and they all came with pitchforks and different implements that they thought they would need in order to put a fire out. And what did they find? They found these wonderful godmen who were surrounded this little stable with these animals, and that Christ was being worshipped, and they all came and they worshipped as well. Isn't that a beautiful thing? And ever since then, that birth has been thought of in that way. And people have mangers, they have crush scenes, they have different representations. When we go down to Mexico, perhaps in other places as well, they don't put the baby Jesus in until Christmas morning, or maybe after midnight, after Mass. And then they put the Christ child in there because he doesn't arrive until then. And so they have that kind of devotion. So Jesus awakened that kind of devotion, his teachings to not harm one another, to love one another, even your enemy. These were brand new to so many different people. They were known in other parts of the world, but they came as an awakening in that part of the world, that all people might enjoy the God realization of being merged in Christ consciousness. You didn't have to be of a certain nobility, you didn't have to go to a certain school, that any sincere heart and mind and soul could accept. And as a result of that, receive this Christ birth deep within the soul. It's beautiful and it's wonderful. And it awakens something new and it influences still all for the better. I'd like to read from Mother here from the journal. At the feet of Papa, at Papa's feet. It was so perfect that he, meaning God, took me to the feet of another master who put me through the crucifixion in order that I might gain final enlightenment. And my life was very little to pay for him. And it was he, Master, who I thought I was praying it for, because he had saved my life so many times. I had given it to him, and he had accepted it, and he took it. Mother, at one point, had tuberculosis, and at that time, it was oftentimes a death sentence. And she had small children, and the doctor was telling that she was going to have to go into a sanatorium. And she had a husband who had no arms, and she took care of him, and she worked for the family, and she took care of the children. And what would happen to her husband and to her children if she had to go into a sanatorium is a very dire circumstance, not to mention the threat of hell. So she sent a telegram to Master and told him what the situation was. And he sent a telegram back and said that he had prayed for her. And the next time that she went in and got the x-rays, before there had been two tuberculosis tumors that were about the size of a silver dollar, she said. And when she went back, they were both gone, not any sign of them whatsoever. She had an ovarian cyst at another time. She said that she was told that it was about the size of a grapefruit, and there was a danger that it could explode and that it would kill her. And they were wanting to do an operation on her, but she was physically in a very weak condition, and she didn't think that she could survive an operation of that sort. So once again, she telegrammed down to Master, and once again, Master sent back that he had prayed for her. And when she went back to the doctor the next time, amazingly, that ovarian cyst was completely gone. And so it's the truth when she says that he saved her life, not once, but many times. And there were other times as well in other ways. Her own daughter, Barbara, had been playing and was standing on a chair. And the son, as a small boy, these were just small children, playfully pushed the chair. But Barbara had fallen off the chair and fallen right on her head on the kitchen floor. And she was unresponsive. And so Mother took her to the hospital, and they said that she very likely had brain damage and that she would never be normal again, and they doubted if she would even walk again. Master was in town, and Mother took Barbara to Master, and he laid her down on his lap, and he passed his hand up and down her spine, and then he would say, "She will be all right." And gradually she recovered everything. She was mentally normal. She was able to walk. She was able to run. She was able to do everything that a child could do. So you see what a tremendous impact this great God-man had on Mother's life and her family's. And she is absolutely devoted to him. She felt that Master was Christ come again. He was so great in God. And she saw many of the changes that began to happen after he left the body. And she was greatly upset. They were changing his words. They were changing his teachings. They were changing photographs. They changed his name. Everything seemed up for sale. And she didn't think that this was right. You know, when a master says something, and Mother said this about Master, sometimes that he spoke the most beautiful English, and other times he simply murdered the king's English. And so he had editors who helped him. English was not his first language, and he didn't learn it really until he was an adult. And it's amazing how beautifully he did speak and how beautifully he did write. But of course, any writer needs help with an editor. That's just something that goes on. So Master had editors helping him with his work. But it seemed that they weren't happy. Sometimes they would make changes, and he would write back, and he would say, "No, I want it left the way that I said it." Well, once he left the body, it seemed like all the gates broke open, and just every editorial change they thought they could make, they did. And there are over 300 changes in the autobiography itself. They changed his name, they changed his signature. It's really quite something when you stop to think about it. And Mother was not in favor of any of this, and this put her in bad favor. Those who were doing all of this, who were at the top of the organization, they didn't like to be gainsaid. They didn't want to be questioned about any of this. They just wanted everybody to go along with it. And Mother wasn't of that mind. She felt that she was being loyal to Master. She is so upset about this, she just knew that there is something that she must be able to do to change this. They had it legally all sewn up. What could she do, just one woman who lived in a distant city? She also wanted her God realization. She was totally focused. She had already attained a high state of consciousness. She had already had been in nirva kalpa samadhi for 11 days. She went into states of bliss, but she knew that there was more. You become solidified. You become stabilized in a state of God realization. even up until the very last moment, you're still going in and out of it. There are times when you are lifted up and other times when you are tested or you have some lesser state of consciousness. And you know that you're not all the way there. You know that you haven't completely purified the mind so that you can remain there. Now it is God alone, ultimately, who can purify the mind. The human ego is by nature imperfect, and so it cannot create perfection, but it must strive for perfection. And it is through the striving and the surrendering of yourself at God's feet that God picks you up and he puts you through all the experiences that are necessary in order to fully realize him. And when you keep your mind on God and you surrender to him completely and totally, then you give him full sway to do everything that he wants, everything that needs to be done in order to perfect yourself. Only God is perfect, and only God can bring you into that state of perfection. Jesus himself said, "Be ye perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." Now, did he ask us to do something that is impossible to do? And that can't be his case. It must be so that his words find fulfillment, because that is true of every great master. The words cannot go unfulfilled. So, Mother was absolutely determined in order to find this great state of realization. And she prayed deeply to God because she felt the gulf between herself and God, that she had not gained the whole thing yet. And she said, "Lord, you yourself must do this, or send someone who can do this." And God replied to her, and he said, "I will come to see you face to face." It was some time after that, not too long after that, Bob Raymer called Mother. And he said, "I have somebody here that I want you to meet. He's tremendous." Now, Bob Raymer told me, it's quite a funny story, when he first met Papa Ramdas, he had heard about him, and so he invited him, without having met him at all, to come and meet, I think it was with his Rotary Club. And they were all businessmen and all men of the world, but he thought it would be interesting, and they would invite different people. So he invited Papa to come and talk to his club. So Papa came, and the entire time that he talked about renunciation, he talked about the evils of the world. And here he's saying this in front of all this Bob Raymer's friends who are all businessmen and all men of the world. And he thinks, "Oh my God, what do they think of me? That I invited this person to come," and seems like they're berating him, or he's berating them. He's so upset about this that when he left, he drove around and drove around. He didn't go back to his office because he was sure he'd be getting one phone call after another. "What in the world did you think, inviting this man to come to talk to us?" So he drove around for so long, and at last he thought, "Well, I have to go back to my office eventually, so I might as well do it now." And he went back, and there were, sure enough, there was a whole stack of messages there. And one after another, they read, "It's so wonderful that you brought this man. We really benefited from his words of wisdom." And there was not one criticism that he got. So he was a brother disciple of Master's, along with Mother, and he called Mother and he says, "This God man is coming to Seattle. You must see him." And so Mother invited him to her home. And she had the meditation center there. It was at that time, it was an SRF center. And she invited him there, and he gave a talk. And he talked about God's grace coming, and how God dispensed his grace. And afterwards, she asked Papa to bless everyone that was there. And he did so because he said he had committed himself by saying what he said during the talk. And then afterwards, Papa, and you can read this in "The World is God," but Papa said something to the effect, "You must be happy now. All of your devotees here, they must be all happy." And she said, "How could we not be when God has come to visit?" And meaning Papa. And Papa said, "Well, it is God who has come to see God face to face." And this is an exact quote of what Mother had heard from God earlier, that I will come to see you face to face. And she is just stunned. And she recognized this is God telling her. It is this man who has come, this great God-man, who has come to take you all the way to himself. And so, as you know, later on she traveled to Anandashram, and there she is put through these tremendous experiences. It can seem odd to some that Mother had such great devotion to Master, and yet she went to India to see this other great Master, but she would oftentimes say, she is the product of two perfect masters. And that if Yogananda had continued to live in the body, perhaps Rajasi also had left the body. So there is nobody qualified to take her through these experiences, and they were of such a profound nature that if she did not have the direct supervision of Papa, his protection, as well as masters on the invisible side, she would not have been able to survive what she went through. She didn't go through it for herself. She went through it for the world. And as a result of that, she went through very powerful, very strong experiences. And so, we are all the beneficiaries of the tremendous life that she left. But that's what took her to Papa's feet. So I'm going to continue now with what she was writing or saying. And it was he, Master, whom I thought I was praying it for. Because he had saved my life so many times, I had given it to him, and he had accepted, and he took it. And so out of all of that, I came to this point. Whatever I may be, God alone knows, I know not. I only know that with everything I am, I belong to the Lord. With every breath I draw, I serve him. That I love him in every form that comes before me. That there is nothing but that he would ask of me that I would not do. And I would ask each and every one of you to examine your own conscience, your own hearts, and ask yourselves if that is true of you. You come and you say you want God realization. Are you willing to give up your life for Christ? Are you willing to give up yourself in order that you may find yourself? Are you willing to go through every test, every single thing that is required of you, in order to find this oneness with God? Or are you just complaining about every little thing? Is your mind working to find fault with this and that? It is filled with doubts. I should be at the source. It should be at the source of all wisdom. It should be on the fountain of all love, God himself, the source of all. And don't forget that he is seated in your heart. He is your very life, your real self. And still you fail to realize that you are willing to settle for the little self, that will give you nothing but grief and sorrow and doubt and ashes in the end. One of the best known signs of divinity of a master is his humanity. Real spiritual advancement makes a person more fully human, not more removed from humanity. The advanced saint or yogi may be so absorbed in his inner experiences that he cannot relate to the mundane details of the gross plan. But the perfect master is perfectly human. I should say that Mother had started to read from a book on Meher Baba, one of the great spiritual masters. Many people expect aloofness in a guru. Look for warmth instead. Many people expect a master to be serenely oblivious to the world. Look instead for an uncanny awareness of everything around him. Many expect a somber countenance, charged with the seriousness of the struggle of the spiritual path. Look instead for one to be both appropriately grave and blissfully lighthearted as the occasion demands. A perfect master has an enlivening sense of humor and a superhuman consideration for your very human worries and problems. He is alive to every look in your eyes, every every tone of your voice, every hope, every wish, every sadness, and every joy. He cares for you and for your ultimate happiness, as is the most loving grandmother, and he shows his care with unimagined tenderness in a thousand unexpected ways. The God-realized Master has plumbed the most esoteric mysteries of the universe, and he experiences a world of infinite consciousness, which is absolutely unknown to the ordinary man. But many seekers feel that such a master would be totally out of their reach, preoccupied and unconcerned with them. But if he is indeed divine, he will show you what it is to be truly human. Beautifully said and absolutely true. I remember the night that Mother invited me to come to dinner to her apartment, and I was so nervous because I thought, how can I entertain her? How can I have conversation with her? I was not somebody who had a lot of conversation. I was very quiet in nature. And I didn't have to worry at all. Mother made me absolutely comfortable. And that she talked to me just as any friend would talk to a friend. And yet, it was so tremendous. It was so uplifting. And she took me into her back room and she showed me many things that she had collected from India and other places. And these were new things to me. And she could be blunt. And that was her humanness. She showed me the picture of one man who is a rather bulky-looking Swami in India. And I didn't know, but she had had a terrible time with this individual on the astral plane. And she didn't think much of him spiritually. And she said, look at him. Doesn't he look like a big, fat slug? And I thought, well, I don't know this individual at all. I didn't know what to say. And then she showed me somebody else, and he was a disciple of Yogananda's, and he was the head of the monks at that time, and I had a picture. She showed me a picture of him, and it said, monks joyfully welcoming back Swami. Or he wasn't a Swami then, I'm sorry, but this individual. And she said, you know, they hated his guts. They really didn't like him at all. This was blunt talk for me, and not knowing much about it, I just accepted it and put it in for consideration and didn't form any one strong opinion one way or the other. And this is the way that I did with Mother. She talked about many things that were outside of my experience and outside of my knowledge. Of course she did. I knew that she wasn't expecting me to just accept every blessed thing that she said because she said it. That this was a path of realization. This is a path of experience. But she was teaching me with everything because then she would back it up and she would tell me the stories of why this individual was not what he should be, this Swami, or why this head of the monks was not what he should be. Now, you can join in and take it as gossip, or you can take it as feeling holier than thou because you're not the one who's being put on the spot in a moment. Or you can take it as teachings, that she's telling you what qualifies you as a realized master and what disqualifies you. What are the things that you would look for in a realized master? You see, we're not taught these things, and many times in India they're not taught it, but it's at least more prevalent in India to know about spiritual masters, to know about gurus, but here we don't get too much of that. So she was teaching me and showing me how to use my discrimination, not just for the world, but for myself. What if I fell into the traps that she was talking about? I would then be armed at least with the knowledge that I had fallen into a trap where if she had never told me about this and didn't tell me about how you can exploit people, how on a astral level you can invade people. I had that experience. There was a Swami who used to make the rounds and he was quite well known. And I had seen him before I met Mother, and I didn't think that much of him. I wasn't drawn to him at all. But I had an opportunity to go and see him talk after I met Mother, and I thought, well, it'd be interesting to go and see him and see what I experience now that I've met Mother. So I went, and I listened to his talk, and I wasn't any more plussed than I had been the first time. But as he was walking out, there seemed to be a separation of people, and he was perhaps 20 feet away from me. And he stopped, and he turned, and he looked directly at me. And I could feel him psychically rummaging around on the inside of me, and I didn't like it. And I immediately thought of Mother, and instantly this light over the top of me began to come down around like a shield all around me. And as soon as that light started to envelop me, his head snapped back around and he kept on walking out, and she had saved me in that moment. Sometimes these spiritual masters are not what they are supposed to be. I'd heard later that he had demonstrated the spiritual power by making a cat crawl on its belly all the way towards him, up to his feet. And everybody was very impressed with this. Well, most everybody was. The person who was telling me was disgusted by it, that he had forced this cat to do this. And you see, we see things like this and we can think, well, how marvelous. You have power to be able to do this. Maybe I'd like to have that power too. And it's absolutely the wrong way to go. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita says that you absolutely eschew any powers that come to you, that a true yogi does, because you can get trapped in that. And that can become a world unto itself. And it doesn't take you anywhere. Sri Yukteswar said you can have power over this entire universe and still lack God realization. So some people equate having superordinary powers with knowing God, but this is not the case. And so we have to be taught how to train our minds on absolute God realization and nothing of what Mother called Mr. In-Between. So we must learn discrimination. It's not just everything that comes down the road that's just all hunky-dory. Things don't add up. You have to look for that purity. Swami Satchidananda was such a lovely example because he is so quiet. He is very different than Mother in that sense. But the feeling of God in him, and God sent me to him because he was to help me toward that final mile myself, and which he did. And I am forever grateful to him for doing that. But he was a very different personality. One of the things that we get by seeing the different personalities of the guru lineage written about, that Lari Mahasaya is very different from Sri Yukteswarji. He was very different from Master. Very different personalities. Yet all are God realized. Papa is very different himself. Matachi. Different, very different. Swamiji, very different. We get the idea, it's not about becoming like someone else. Or you don't have to learn how to talk with an Indian accent. That doesn't make you holy. These are just things that people adopt in order to try to increase their standing. It's all ego. You don't become like someone else. You become yourself, your true self. You have never felt more at home than when you are God realized. You never have felt more yourself than when you know God. We think with the language that you have to surrender yourself, that you die, and all of that has a truth to it. But it's not death in as if you cease to exist. You cease to exist on that which does not serve you. That which is just pure ego consciousness. And it keeps you in a state of separation. It keeps you from your happiness. And really, it keeps you from being who you truly are. Many of us grew up with this feeling that our families weren't our real families. I certainly had that feeling. And that this world seemed like a strange place. There's a book one time called Stranger in a Strange Land. And it describes many of our experiences in growing up. It's when you find God realization that you really find yourself. That's the strange irony. All of this giving up and all of this dying, it is true. We die to the little self. We die to those things that keep us in a state of separation. But we are reborn. We are reborn into our true self. We're born into enlightenment. And there is nothing greater than that. Occasionally you hear where it's said that the Buddha was an atheist. And this is not the case at all. He, when asked about afterlife, when he is asked about is there a God and all such things, he said, why have any mental speculation about this? Get to work. Get your realization. This is paraphrasing what he said. But get to work and get your own realization. Achieve that state of nirvana. Now, he didn't invent that term. That was a Hindu term. But he didn't want a lot of focus on the gods and the goddesses and so on. I think he must be very disappointed when he looks down on this earth. I don't think there's been any statue that's been duplicated more than the Buddha's. You see them everywhere. And he would just shake his head, and I would think he would say, you just can't escape it, can you? The mind wants something to focus upon. It thinks in subject-object relationship. It wants something to focus on. Even if you think about the nothingness of God, you create some image in your mind of what the nothingness of God is. You can't really enter into that state unless God takes you into it. He took me into that state. And when I was in that state, it really is the nothingness. I existed, I was conscious, but nothing of myself existed. I had no reaction to this world. Somebody told me, it feels like you're dead. And something from deep inside of me said, I am dead. And I had absolutely no response to it. And in that sense, I was dead. I was certainly dead to the old self, and I just was not operating in this world. Although I was walking, it was like being in a dream and knowing that you're dreaming, and just having no real relationship with it. And this went on for quite some time. God puts you through these things not just to test you, not just to constantly examine you, but he empties you out. Jesus said you don't pour new wine into an old wineskin. Rather, you start out with a new wineskin. Your wineskin is you. It's your ego consciousness. It's your sense of self. And God is going to completely take that apart. Now, you can't do this yourself. God has to do it and take you through these experiences. But he takes you apart, piece by piece, and sometimes whole chunks at a time. And you have to surrender to it. You have to let him have his way. Because if you don't, you're preserving that which should not be preserved. You're keeping yourself from going into that state of realization. So this is something that you must know going into it. Because you get into the middle of these experiences and you wonder, what in the world did I do to myself? And how do I get out of it? And then you realize this is God orchestrating this from beginning to end. And it does test you to the very hilt. But if you will endure it, if you will keep your mind on God, keep surrendering to him every bit of the way, do your part to purify yourself, God will do the rest. Listen to his direction. Listen to his higher light. If you know you should be doing something and you're not doing it, this is an excellent time to begin to think of yourself as having self-mastery. Now you may think, but I don't have self-mastery. I do these things in spite of what I think. And so you grow in your mind. You grow your God self-image. Who is that person inside of you who has that self-mastery? It already exists because you are already a God-realized person. You just haven't realized it yet. All the capacity, all the potential is there. So when you think in this wise, when you think the opposite, and you say, well, I've never been able to do that, I'm a failure, I can't do that, that's asking too much, I've tried and tried and tried again, it's because you haven't accessed that pure, perfect self that already exists inside of you. It's already there. You don't have to create it. You just need access to it. You need to allow it to come forward. And if you suffer a belief system that you're no good, that you're filled with darkness, that you never do it right, that the world never gives you what you're looking for, that may be true. But God will give you what you're looking for. Well, I've tried that. I've prayed to God. Well, you haven't prayed deeply enough. You haven't gone far enough. You've not made that contact. Because when you do, that perfection comes forward in you. That realization begins to grow inside of you. Invisible forces come in to support you. And that is what gives you the power to change. And to become the God self that you're intended to be. Continuing on with Mother. The Master tests the disciples in many ways. I remember when I first went to India, I had visions of spending long hours in meditation, of doing certain types of sadhana. I didn't know what to expect from Swami Ramdas because I didn't go over there really to get my God realization from him. I went over there on my Master's behalf because of my great love for him and my great concern for his work. And so I said to Papa one day, Papa, what would you like us to do? And he looked at me and he said, Ramdas wishes that you would do nothing. And that stopped me. I thought, what am I supposed to do? Sit here with my hands folded, just do nothing? That doesn't seem very wise or very smart. How am I going to get to God that way? But I took it inside of myself and I meditated on it. All of a sudden, the answer came. He didn't want me, the human ego, to do anything. He wanted me to relinquish it totally, absolutely. And to let God, who is the very life, the dweller in this form, do all things through me and for me. Now this is a tremendous realization. Now if we get that information too early, we really do get stymied. But when you start to feel God moving through you, you learn what surrender really is. In the beginning, you surrender to the higher light inside of you, the things you know you should be doing. But that's more of a mental apprehension of what is right for you. When God awakens inside of you and you feel that peace, you feel that bliss, you will start to get that inner direction. It's not always clear to you because the mind is not totally purified. But we strive for that inner direction. And we want to do the right thing. And as we continue down that path, the mind gets more and more purified until we really do know what the right thing is. We go according to the highest light that we know. We let God do the work. And we are completely at His mercy, so to speak. We are totally focused on Him. We become like a marionette that God operates. But we're not a dumb, unconscious marionette. We're very much alive. We're very conscious. We're very aware. And He works through us time and time again. And you become that perfect instrument that God is operating through. This is the most wonderful, the most beautiful, the most powerful life you can possibly imagine entering into. And it's right here. It's right here. It's something for you to begin to enact, even in this moment.